Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out all the other things that 1517 is doing. I mean, have you guys taken any Academy courses yet? There's a new Academy course. Chad, I don't know if you've seen the trailer for this, and it might not be public, but I've seen it. And by the time this releases, it may very well be public. But there's a new academy course that's being released on the Church Fathers with Bruce Hillman, and man, the trailer is something to behold. I'll tell you what, keep your eye out for it. If it's not out yet, it will be out very soon. I'll tell you what, I'm taking that course for sure. It's been a little bit since I delved into the Church Fathers, so I would like a new refresher. Man, it looks really, really good. And of course, you know, like so many things at 1517, virtually everything at 1517, it's free. So all you gotta do is sign up, and then you can be smarter than all those other Christian friends around you and be like, yeah, but have you thought about patristics lately? Have you thought about that? Let me talk to you about some of the old church controversies. Let me talk to you about the characters. Let me tell you like what they fought about. It's gonna be good. And Bruce Hillman's he's a smart guy. That's his field of expertise. So he's going to be a great guide through that. So if not that, you know, you can sign up for Chad's course in the Old Testament. There's a ton of academies. Go check some of those out, or anything else that we're doing over at 1517. Chad, we are in Job chapter 9. Job is given his response. He's talking about how in his mind he has ceased to maybe... He's sort of giving up on this idea that he is going to win an argument with God. He has now said that, look, man, if I could like give an answer to 1,000 questions, you know, like I'm probably going to get all these wrong. I don't even know like how to argue with God. He's the guy that's making the sunshine and he's making the rain come. He's doing all these things. I don't know how to argue with this guy. But I'll tell you one thing, and we kind of ended with this shocking thing that he says, because his friend had said, look, man, God's not going to judge the blameless. Job says, I think he is going to do that, actually, and says, when disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. He says that the earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the face of his judges. If it is not he, then who is it? And the big statement is, I say this, buddy. I say that he destroys both the blameless and the wicked.
Yeah, that's based upon everything Job has experienced. That is his conclusion.
Yeah,
it's inescapable with regard to what he sees and what he's gone through. That if it's not God doing this, then who would it be? So it's a rhetorical question. Of course, it's God who does all this, Job says. He destroys the righteous along with the wicked. Now, verse 25, he's going to shift gears, and he's going to talk about the brevity of human life through several images. And then he's going to move from there to basically lament that no matter what he does, whether it's good or bad, things always seem to turn out the same way. So he starts with three different images for how fast life goes by. He says, my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed. And then the third one is like an eagle swooping on its prey. So swifter than a runner, I mean, that's a fairly common biblical image. The skiffs of reed, one commentator called this an Egyptian speedboat. So These are lightweight boats. They're made of papyrus. So they're not heavy. So they're not weighted down. So they go pretty quickly. And then the eagle swooping on its prey. I mean, I think we've probably all seen, maybe not an eagle, but a hawk that just drops out of the sky and comes up with something in its talons. And that's what he says his life is like. Now, this might seem a bit contradictory, because Job has also said that his days seem to drag by. In fact, he wishes that they would go faster so that he would just be done with it and be in the grave already. But, I mean, this is the way it is when you're suffering. You don't necessarily have to. You don't are incapable of maintaining any kind of logical consistency.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it seems like time drags by. Sometimes it seems like it goes in a hurry. But anyway, he moves then, verse 27, to say, if I say, I will forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face. And be of good cheer. So if you know, I'm just gonna I'm going to pretend like everything's okay. I'm going to take off my sad face. I'm going to be happy. I'm going to smile. Then he says, if I try that, it doesn't work because I become afraid of all my sufferings. So the fear is not going to leave. He could pretend to be okay. He can put a smile on his face, but it won't do any good because fear is always there. Fear of the sufferings that he has endured, that he is going to endure, and that he still is going to endure. Because he ends that by saying, because I know that you will not hold me innocent. I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? So this is more of his, it's like he's looked at all his options, and everywhere he looks, every door closes in his face. There's nothing he is able to do, whether it's faking it, whether it's, trying to cry to heaven, whatever it might be. Nothing is moving him any closer to figuring out where he stands with God, which is, of course, the looming question behind all of this. Where is God, and why has he turned either his back against me or begun to attack me?
Yeah, I mean, Job is in a situation where even doing something like putting away his complaint and saying, all right, I'm going to be of good cheer, which, by the way, seems like a total impossibility. I mean, you're covered in boils, sitting on a trash. I mean, there's no way to...
Good probably, luck with that.
Yeah, there's probably no... You would have to fake this. I mean, there's no way to do this genuinely. But he's saying, like, all of that, that would be a labor. I mean, that would take some doing. Why go through all that? Why, like, play that game when the outcome is the same? I mean, like, I'm still going to be condemned. At least that's how it is in his mind. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no point in me acting like anything is different than it is because it won't change the outcome at all.
Yeah, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation. Yeah. No matter what he tries, and he goes on to use some pretty memorable images. So if I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye. So if I go to these extremes, I find some snow, I'm going to just bathe in snow. White snow will clearly make me clean. Let me get some lye, in fact. Wash my hands in lye. If I make myself, as clean as humanly possible, then he goes on in verse 31, yet you will plunge me into a pit, which should probably be translated like a slime pit. So I'm going to clean myself up. I'm going to take a bath in snow. I'm going to bathe in lye. I'm going to get myself really clean. Well, if I do that, it's not going to do me any good because you're going to throw me into a cesspool, basically. And even my clothes, my own clothes will abhor me. I'm going to stink so bad. So nothing I try is going to help. Then in verse 32, he says, for he, talking about God here, he is not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to trial together. There is no arbiter. I like the translation of umpire better here. There's no umpire between us who might lay his hand on both of us. Let him take his rod away from me, and let not dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak without fear of him, for I am not so in myself. So it's part of his frustration is that, if you and I, Dan, if we had an issue, and suppose that, it was serious enough to where we couldn't even talk to each other on friendly terms, but we had a common friend. Like, common friend could, like, step between us, and he could even, like, put his hand on your shoulder, put his hand on my shoulder, and say, listen, guys, let's talk through this. Okay, if we had somebody like that, an arbiter, a go-between, an umpire, well, then he could at least kind of work with us, because both of us are men and both of us are mortal. And, someone who's thinking rationally and is more of an objective party, like an umpire is supposed to be, then they would be able to help us to solve whatever dispute we have. But Job says, I can't do that because I'm a man and he's God. So there's no way that he is going to answer me, that we can go to trial together. There can be some kind of umpire between us. There's no way in which we can resolve our conflict because of the gross disparity between the two of us. And so I just wish that he would take his rod, quit hitting me with his rod so that I wouldn't be living in terror all the time. But I love how he ends. He said, then I would speak without fear of him. But of course, he does go on to speak. Well, see, that last verse seems to say, you know what? I'm going to keep on speaking no matter what. It's the only thing I can do is talk to God. So that is what I will continue to do, even though much of my words seem to be spoken in vain.
Yeah, and he's saying, I mean, I would speak without fear. That would imply that right now you are going to speak, but you're going to do so in fear, right? So you
can do so in fear, yeah.
Yeah, you don't have this umpire. What he's looking for is somebody say like, well, all right, if I had someone that could call balls and strikes here, we might be able to hash this out. But the problem is that I'm going to say, hey, that's a strike, and then God's going to say, nope, no, it's not. And then I'm just going to be left to say, oh, okay, because he's God. Yeah. So like, there's nobody no one can be placed in a position of authority in this complaint, because my complaint is with the highest authority. This is a real problem for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He loses. He loses every game. There is no winning game for Job in this controversy. So there's a chapter break here. That was the end of chapter 9, beginning of chapter 10. But I mean, there's really no break in the speech itself. It's just a handy break here, because Job is gonna continue. And he starts out with I loathe my life, which is very much like Job chapter 3. In fact, there's going to be several Job chapter 3 kind of utterances in Job chapter 10. I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. So that's riffing off of that closing verse of chapter 9. He's speaking. Yeah, he's speaking fearfully, but he's still going to speak. He's going to give free utterance to his complaint, and he's going to speak in the bitterness of his soul. And here's what he goes on to say. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands, and favor the designs of the wicked? Have you eyes of flesh? Do you see as man sees? Are your days as the days of man, or your years as a man's years, that you seek out my iniquity and search for my sin? Although you know I am not guilty, and there is none to deliver you out of my hand. So he's going to say to God all these words, but in the end, it doesn't seem to do any good, because even though he can say these words to God, in the end, he knows that God knows that he's not guilty, but still there's none who's going to be able to deliver him out of God's hand.
Yeah, this situation is like, yeah, you got to be frustrated if you're Job, because he's sitting there like, I am not guilty of anything, but God, I feel like God is treating me as though like I'm the most guilty person that's ever lived, but I also know that he knows that's not true. So what, like, I mean, this is the vexation, right? Right, where you're like, what is going on here? Now, I can't attribute this to anyone but God, but also I know that God must know that I'm not at fault here, otherwise he wouldn't be God.
Yeah. I mean, it's the classic dilemma. It's a classic living, trying to figure out the contradiction, the seeming contradiction between, okay, God is good, God is all-knowing, and then at the same time, if God is all good and all-knowing, then, you know, why is there not only so much evil and suffering in the world, but so much suffering in my own life? You know, if God loves me, then why is everything that I'm experiencing so hateful and so painful? It's a contradiction that we all struggle with when we're in the midst of trials and tribulations, but especially Job, because Job was the, as we've said multiple times, the moral cream of the crop. So if all these things are happening to him and he's done nothing to deserve them, and if God is good and if God is all knowing and God knows that he doesn't deserve this, then why in the world has all of this befallen him?
Yeah, I mean, you can think about this as like a parent, right? So if say your kid gets really sick, right? So like every parent has had that happen where you're, you know, I've got a little baby, and she had she got some kind of bacterial infection thing a while back, and she was all miserable and coughing and all this stuff. Now, because I love her, you think, if I could stop this, I totally would. Like, it wouldn't even be like a, wouldn't even be a decision for me, right? To be like, hey, you have the power to take this away.
Instantly, yes.
Would you like to do it? You're like, absolutely, I would like to do it. She's just miserable and suffering here, so I'm going to, I would, no question about it, I'll take this away. And then you think about God, and you're like, okay, so I'm God's child, and he says he loves me, and then here I am suffering like crazy, and I have to believe that he does have the power, and yet nothing's happening. And this creates a real dilemma in us, because you're like, surely God's better than me. And the answer to that, of course, is he is better than you. Yeah. But you're like, but that's not what I would do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is the ongoing, that's the ongoing issue with any kind of suffering, because when we see it, we immediately want to end it. I mean, if we're, especially if it's somebody that we care about, I mean, if it's a child or if it's a spouse or anybody that we care about, and we see them suffering, we immediately want that to end. And we, you know, judge, I think rightly, that would be the good thing to do, but we don't see God acting that way. And so we compare what we would do with what we see God doing or what we think we see God doing. And yeah, at times we end up kind of like Job, like what's going on? Why is this continuing? Why don't you stop the suffering? And I mean, that is the human dilemma that this people struggle with throughout the generations. That's the main theme of Job, and that's, you know, at some points in our lives, that's our struggle as well.
It was, and this is the answer to this question, while not maybe that comforting, is that we would do all those things in the moment, because the moment is what we have, and in the moment is as far as we can see. And so God is not like that. God sees well past this moment and the next moment and a million moments after that. And so, well, if I had all that power, my daughter would never be sick, and she'd also never have an immune system. You know, so that she would never be built up in any way. Her body would never learn any of these things, and that might be a trite example. But what it means is that God knows like what it is that he is doing in the midst of suffering, whereas we would just respond to the moment, to the suffering itself, have no regard for what may be happening. And what can come out of it later. And so this is why Paul will say that God works all things together for good. And as I've said, I think, numerous times on the podcast, of course, Paul is necessarily talking about bad things, because I can work good things together for good. It takes not very much effort or or power to make good things good. They're just sort of already good. And so, yeah, Paul is talking about bad things, suffering, persecution, all of that kind of stuff. And God is able to work those things for good. Now, that does take someone bigger and more powerful than ourselves. It also takes somebody who can see the end from the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I tell myself a lot of times when I think about my own sufferings or the sufferings of those close to me, is that, yeah, we have a very limited perspective. And what we see is today, and, you know, maybe we look a little bit into the future, but we can't see all things at all times, and we certainly can't see the good that's going to come out of the sufferings that we endure, but God can. And so he uses that in order to empty us of ourselves and to draw us closer to himself. And along the way, yeah, I mean, we trust that he's doing what is best, but at the same time, we can also cry out these kinds of words from Job. It's not as if we just have to simply remain silent and say, okay, well, you're God and I'm not, and I guess everything's going to be all right in the end, because we still continue to struggle. And so we still continue to pray and to lament and do all the things that Job does. So it's not an either or. In other words, we can know that, yes, God is going to use our sufferings in some way for good, and at the same time, cry out in those sufferings why and how long and what in the world's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if we had our way, we'd be asking God to give us the kind of life that we would never need him for anything. Can you just make it to where I have zero dependency on you? That I can you make? Can you give me a sort of life where I never have to really trust you, really? Can you give me a life that doesn't require any faith? And the answer to all those things is no. God won't give you that.
No.
And he won't give you that.
And the reason
because
he won't.
This is not good for you.
Yeah, because he loves us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be, it would be unloving of God to construct our lives in such a way that everything went well for us. Because if everything went well for us, then in the end, we would be very unwell because we would just walk like what you were describing. We would become independent, or think we were independent anyway. And with that would come pride, and with pride would come all the other things that always accompany pride.
Well, the biggest thing you become is faithless, which is the worst thing to become.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So back to Job, we're at verse 8. He's going to use some very creative language here. I mean, some of it's found in other parts of the scriptures, but what Job uses here to describe how God makes us, some of this is uniquely Job's contribution, especially the part about curdling like cheese. It's nowhere else found in the Bible. But so this is I'll read 8-13 because this is all about God's creation of us, and we'll get to Job's point kind of at the end. Your hands fashioned and made me, and now you have destroyed me altogether. Remember that you have made me like clay, and will you return me to the dust? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? You clothed me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. You have granted me life and steadfast love, and your care has preserved my spirit. Yet these things you hid in your heart. I know that this was your purpose. Now, the overall message of this seems to be, listen, God, so you spent a lot of time and effort and carefully creating who I am. Your hands fashioned me. You made me. You know, you took clay and you formed me, or you poured me like milk that then curdled into cheese. You knit me with bones and sinews. You were engaged in artistry, in other words, in making me. Now you're destroying me. And that makes no sense. I mean, it'd be like Michelangelo finishes painting the Sistine Chapel, and then he sets it on fire.
Yeah.
there's this irrationality that Job is focusing here on. So if you're a good and a gracious and a careful and a seemingly loving creator, because you granted me life and steadfast love, then why are you destroying your creation? Why, after making me from clay, are you returning me to dust? You know, why, after clothing me with skin and flesh, are you now ripping it off of me so that I'm going through the pain and the suffering that I'm enduring?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I mean, it makes no sense that, like, why would you invest anything into me if all you were going to do is destroy it? Why waste your time?
Yeah. I mean, there's echoes of all this kind of language in other parts of the scripture. I mean, Isaiah 64 says, we are the clay and you are the potter. We're all the work of your hands. And Psalm 119 has the same language, like your hands made me and fashioned me. But then it goes on to say, give me understanding that I may learn your commandments. So the same kind of creation language is echoed elsewhere. But what Job does with it is unique, because most of the time when you hear about God creating us, it's in a psalm of praise or something like that. But Job turns everything around. He says, okay, well, if A is true, then why is B happening? If you've created me, why are you uncreating me? If you so carefully painted this portrait, why now are you ripping it to shreds? It doesn't make any sense to Job. That's the overall. It's like he's taking Genesis 2, and then he's saying, okay, you did all this wonderful work in Genesis 2. Now, why are you undoing it in my in my own life.
Yeah. I mean, to Job, it feels like you love me, so why are you treating me like you hate me? Right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's somewhat akin to Psalm 22, verse 1, right? My God, why have you forsaken me?
Yeah.
You know, you are my Father, so why am I going through what I'm going through? Yeah, and I love the fact that verse 12 says, you have granted me life and steadfast love. Mm-hmm. Your care has preserved my spirit. So this is Job really focusing not just on God's, God isn't just Job's maker. I mean, it didn't make him just to have something to make or to display his power. He did it because he wanted Job to live. He did it because he loves Job. In fact, his care preserved him all of these years. So Job has experienced the manifold love of God and his care in his life. He's experienced that over and over and over. So now he's living with the struggle of this contradiction from his past to his present.
Yeah, there's a real sort of accusation there in verse 13, following up on. So like, hey, you gave me, granted me, gifted me life and steadfast love, and your care has preserved my spirit. Yet these things you hid in your heart. I know that this was your purpose. Like, it was like to hide the reason for these things was like what you had planned all along.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he feels, I don't know, maybe this isn't right, but it's like he feels deceived by God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the, I mean, I have felt that way.
Like set up. Like
maybe I'm reading my own. Yeah, like he's set up. Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm reading my own experience into this. But you know, it's one of these where you thinking, oh man, God is blessing me, and then all of a sudden it's ripped away. It's like, was he though, or was he leading me on this entire time in order that he could just rip it away at the last minute? It's easy to read your own experiences into Job.
Yes.
I don't want to do that, but at the same time, yeah, it's with a book like this, it's hard not to.
Dude, I got this. This is a very trite example, but it popped into my head because it just happened to me. I was on Thanksgiving, and my niece came up to me. Now, I'm a fan of, I don't like candy that much, but I do like sour apple candy. She came up to me with this with this candy cane. It's all green. And she said, I got you the best sour apple candy cane that there is. I was like, sweet. And I took it and put it in my mouth, and it was a sour cream and onion candy cane. And I knew at that moment that that was her purpose all along.
Oh, that's great.
Job has the most extreme version of this happening.
Yeah, this is another tried example. My kids would often do the same thing if we went out to eat. They would, if I had to leave the table for a minute, they would switch my Dr. Pepper for root beer, which I despise. Root beer is the most disgusting drink ever. And so all I would have to do is take one sip and knew that I had been tricked by my children. They're just supposed to love and care for me.
Yeah. How can you be from Texas and not like like a good old sarsaparilla, man?
Oh man, I have tried. I thought as a child, I thought when I grew up, maybe I'd outgrown my disgust for root beer, but I've tried it, and no, I have not. It is antipathy toward root beer that I will have my entire life.
This is
sorry to all you root beer lovers out
this
there.
This is information that I didn't know, but will store away. I will pick up the mantle next time you get up to leave the table for me.
Oh, so yeah, you take our examples there, you amplify them. Well, we've experienced things like this. I have, and probably a lot of our folks listening have too, where you kind of feel tricked.
Yeah, you gave me all these things. It's God. You gave me all these things. He's acknowledging I didn't earn them, you granted all the things I have in life, the life itself. You granted these things to me, but it seems to me that you did that just so that you would have something to take away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the end of that section. Now, verse 14 and following, he's going to kind of go into one of these other rants or laments where it's like, doesn't matter which way he goes, either way, it's going to be wrong. He says, if I sin, you watch me and do not acquit me of my iniquity. If I'm guilty, woe to me. But if I'm in the right, I can't lift up my head because I'm filled with disgrace and look on my affliction. And were my head lifted up, you would hunt me like a lion and again work wonders against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your vexation toward me, and you bring fresh troops against me. So there's some disputes over the translation of that last line of verse 17, but the ESV has you bring fresh troops against me, which is a remarkable image. It's like God isn't just God that's attacking me. It's like he's recruited a whole army. And as soon as one group of troops wear out, he's like, we got some fresh ones here. They'll start the onslaught once more.
Yeah, it's like if you were being flogged and all day, and this guy was flogging you, just wore himself out, and so he had to be done. His arm was given out, and you think, man, thank God that's over. And then like he just tag teams another guy, brand new guy in there. He's got a fresh arm. Yeah, that is a vivid picture. That is a bummer. There is no relief. Anytime, whatever is oppressing me wears itself out, he just swaps in for someone that's just woke up from a nice long sleep and is ready to go.
Yeah, yeah, just down to Red Bull and he's full of energy. So, but he starts out there with talking about, okay, if I sin. All right. So if I do wrong, you're going to watch me. You're going to see it. I can't do this without you knowing. And so you're not going to acquit me of my iniquity. So if I sin, well, that's not going to work out. If I'm guilty, woe to me, he says. But then he goes on to say, well, if I'm in the right, well, that doesn't do me any good either, because I'm hanging my head low. I can't even lift my head. I'm filled with disgrace. So either way I go, whether I'm a sinner or whether I'm not, whether I rebel, whether I don't, either way, it's a losing game for me. In fact, if I were to lift up my head, then you'd like, get your chariot, get your bow, and then you'd hunt me down like a lion and work your wonders against me. So, and I think that transition, and that's verses 14 through 17. I think that transition kind of puts Job now into a very even darker mood. And he kind of regresses back to where he started in chapter 3 in these next few verses, because this is when he begins to basically say he wishes he were dead. So verse 18, why did you bring me out of the womb? Would that I had died before any eye had seen me. And or as though I had not been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Then cease and leave me alone, that I may find a little cheer before I go, and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of gloom, like thick darkness, like deep shadow, without any order, where light is as thick darkness. I think Job pulled out his thesaurus for this last couple of verses. He like looked up darkness. He's like, okay, what are some other words for darkness? Because you got like four or five Hebrew words there that all refer to darkness.
Well, I mean, it seems as though Job's first utterance is that I wish I had never been born, or I wish I could die. And then, he gets a little back and forth with two of his friends. And in this last response here, he seems that he's saying, okay, let me explain to you how all of this feels, how this is from my vantage point, and then I will return and explain to you again why it is that it seems as though it would have been better for me to have never been born. Like, why would you bring me out of the womb if the whole plan here was to have me be born, give me a bunch of stuff so that you could take that stuff away and then I could just suffer. It would have been better if none of this would have ever happened. So no eye sees me. I'm never born. That would be better. Since that's off the table now, how about you just leave me alone? That I might find a little cheer. The cheer here, I suppose, would just be to not have God around in his mind afflicting him. And then he can just die. Like, the cheer is knowing that God has left me, so now I can die.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to be at this point thinking that it's not like God has moved away from him. It's like God is too close.
Yeah.
And the God who's too close is not the good and the gracious creator God, but the God who musters the troops in various waves to attack him. So, you know, since, you know, like you said, since I didn't die in the womb, since I wasn't carried from the womb to the grave, but now I'm living and experiencing all of this pain, then at the very least, just kind of step away. Give me some space. Because better is my life where you're not in it, where you're not afflicting me, in order that I can just simply go, maybe smile a little bit, have a little cheer before I go into the land of darkness.
I think it's interesting, and maybe there's nothing here, but as he looks up all his words for darkness, there is something interesting that he knows that as long as God is near him, he cannot embrace the darkness, right? So God has to leave before I can go into a place of deep darkness and deep shadows. Obviously, I can't do that with God around.
Because
that's not where you end up with God. And so I need God to abandon me fully, not to just be against me, but I need him to abandon me completely so that then I can go to a place where there is no light. The light is not there. It's just thick darkness and shadow. But that is impossible to do if God is right next to you.
It's like, I think it's Psalm 139. Even the darkness is not dark to you, yeah. And the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are the same to God. So the only way you're going to get away from God in the darkness is the only way you're going to be in the darkness is for God to disappear. And that, which is, of course, what Job wants to happen. But that's not going to happen because that's not who God is. Now, of course, we know the story, of course, from the opening chapters of Job. Job doesn't know exactly why all this is happening to him, but we do. And we know, and I suspect that despite his protest and despite his laments, that Job knows in some way that God will not do what he says. He's not going to leave. Because he's the kind of God who, I mean, like Job said earlier, who created him to give him a life, and he's the God of steadfast love. He's a God who has shown Job many blessings over the years. And so he's not going to abandon Job, just like he's not going to abandon us. The Psalms say the same thing, you know, go away from me, leave me alone that I may smile again before I depart and am no more. And every time we pray that, God says, nope.
Yeah.
Won't do it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with praying it. I mean, I pray that in the Psalms, but God says, no, I will not abandon you in the darkness. And I'm going to stay right here and you can keep hurling your words toward me and I will take them. I will listen. And I will be with you in the midst of your grief and your pain and your confusion and all of that, because I'm the God who actually is the God of life and steadfast love. And I won't abandon you. In fact, I'll carry you through this until finally you get to the end of your own book of Job and are able to look back and realize that I was right there with you through it all.
Yeah. Amen. Well, all right. Well, that's it. That's Job's response. Next episode, we'll get into the third friend, and man, he's great. I think that you guys are gonna really love
so
him.
Far. Yeah, he's just full of compassion.
Yeah, you're gonna really like this. You need more friends like this in your life for sure. We'll get into that next episode, Chad. I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.